And I believe that a novel should be a pleasure to read, because we should please our readers. We should not torture our readers.
Herzlich willkommen zu Hansa Rauschen, dem Literaturpodcast des Hansa Verlages. Mein Name ist Florian Kessler. Hier sprechen alle zwei Wochen Lektorinnen und Lektoren mit Menschen aus der Welt der Bücher, mit Schreibenden und Lesenden, mit Leuten von anderen Verlagen und aus dem Haus. Es geht um alles, was in Bücher passt und außenrum passiert. Und das ist wirklich nicht wenig.
Erst vor wenigen Tagen jährte sich zum 10. Mal ein Moment, der 2011 für Aufbruch, Bewegung, Optimismus stand. Der arabische Frühling schwappte damals durch die arabische Welt. Ab dem 25. Januar wurde in ägyptischen Städten und bald vor allem auf dem berühmten Tahrirplatz in Kairo demonstriert. Ein Jahrzehnt später erscheint nun bei Hansa ein Roman, der diese Zeit und ihre Stimmung nachzeichnet. Von einem Schriftsteller, der in der arabischen Welt berühmt ist und der infolge des Rückschlags gegen den arabischen Frühling aus Ägypten fliehen musste. Seine Republik der Träumer kann in Ägypten nicht erscheinen. Er selbst würde dort im Land sehr sicher ins Gefängnis kommen. Unser Lektor Piero Salabé hat bereits vor längerer Zeit und sogar vor Corona mit Ala al-Aswani in New York über Ala al-Aswanis Schreiben gesprochen, über Ala al-Aswanis Vorbilder und über den Zustand des Exils. Ein Zustand, der auch manchen der mutigen, genau beobachteten Figuren des großen Romans Republik der Träumer blüht. Viel Spaß mit diesem wichtigen Buch und mit Hansa Rauschen.
It's a great pleasure to be together with Ala al-Aswani, one of the most important writers from the Arabic world. He has been translated, his novels have been translated into 37 languages. Is that correct?
Yes.
And I would have loved to meet Ala al-Aswani in Cairo, in his beloved city. Many of his works take place there. But we are now in New York. How come that you have moved to New York?
Well, thank you very much, first, for this interview, and second, it's really a pleasure to meet you, my dear friend. I have been banned from writing in Egypt in the first months when Mr. Sisi became the president. So I was banned first from writing in the Egyptian newspapers, and then banned from any TV appearance, and then banned from, even practically banned from, publishing my books, because my latest novel was published in Lebanon. So I began to come to the US to teach creative writing, and then every time I got back to Egypt with difficulties and problems, because I was always they kept me waiting in the airport, and investigations, and they double check. Sometimes they check three times my luggages, and all this just to to give me hard time.
So, but this happened 5 years ago.
Or? Yeah, for 5 years now. I didn't write one single word in Egypt.
Incredible.
But with the latest novel,
yes,
things got even worse, because
so your latest novel, just to remind us, was published already
in Lebanon,
yeah, Beirut, under the title The Republic as If.
Yes.
This novel will be published in Germany, and we will have probably a different title, which will be The Republic of the Dreamers.
Yes.
Die Republik der Träumer. So this novel was published in Lebanon, but you had more problems after that.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I was in Egypt when it was published, and then they made the war in the media against me of this because of this novel. Of course, they didn't say the real reason why they are angry. So they picked up some scenes, and they said that those scenes are sexual scenes and against our religion as Muslims and against our traditions in the society. I mean, it's totally nonsense. They didn't want to say why they were angry from the novel. I know, of course, anybody would read the novel will know. And I came here because I had a contract to teach at Dartmouth University. And then when I came here, they made a military case against me. A military case in Egypt means that you're going to prison.
So this happened against you because of the novel?
Because of my novel. And some articles too, but basically because of my novel. And of course, I didn't send any lawyer because for two reasons. I don't believe that I should be brought to a military court because I'm not a military man and I'm a writer. And second, because I know that it won't make any difference because in a military court, the decision, the sentence is in the desk.
Hmm.
So why? Because the judge is a colonel and he takes orders from a general. And then the sentence is in the desk. And all the trial and the court and the hearings, and it's a theater, you know. So my lawyers, my friends said that you don't have to come back now.
So there are different means of banning an author from, you know, writing and having direct contact with his readership. What happened with your book, The Republic As If, which is a book that was very critical about the process of the revolution, how it, you know, ended. It was published in Beirut, in Lebanon. But do Egyptian readers have the chance to read this book?
Absolutely.
How do they do?
Well, usually there are, of course, it's not legal and I'm against it, but this
piracy.
Is what happened, piracy. And of course, and online also.
Also online.
Also online.
But could I buy your book in a bookshop in Cairo?
No, not only you cannot buy. If you will be caught with the book, you will go to prison.
My God. Yeah.
So I advise all my friends not to bring the book to the Cairo airport, because if they will find the book, you will be arrested.
My God. And there was a trial, or there was an official ban of your book, or how does that work?
No, I mean, of course I'm banned from everything, and even on TV, I'm banned. We were planning with this TV journalist, we were planning, you know, a long interview on TV, and then he called me and he said, an officer from the military service intelligence called me and he said that you're not allowed, and he's not allowed. Very good.
So we see that an artist, a novelist who wants to express his freedom of art, of telling stories, cannot do this in the proper way in his own country. Let's go back to the beginning of your writing. Because the thing is that you happen to be a political writer, but not so much, in my impression, because you decided it. But the circumstances forced you to get into that position, because you started to write from a completely different aspiration when you were writing your first text. You are a scientist, you are a medical doctor. How come that you started to write your first novel?
I must say something at the beginning that, you know, the word politics is used in the West in a different way because we don't have politics in Egypt. When you say you're German or you're Italian and you, when you say I go to politics. The politics means that, and this is a democratic term. It means that you have ideas and you would like to get elected to apply your ideas in ruling your country. This is politics. We don't have this. We have only one dictator in this since 1952. There is only one leader. And everybody who will criticize this leader will be in big trouble. And the leader considers himself a kind of unique genius. Accordingly, I was not in politics. I was in the combat, I was in the struggle for freedom, you know. And you cannot be, as a writer, you cannot stay away of this struggle, because literature, in my opinion, is an art, in one sense, is an artistic defense of the human values.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so you can, if you write novels to defend the human values, and you find people in your country killed because they asked for their rights, you should do something about it. So I was never, and I'm not interested in politics, but I have been from the very beginning in the struggle for the human values in Egypt.
Your novel, The Jacobean Building, is a novel that describes very strongly, critically, but also with irony and with much love, the Egyptian society, especially in Cairo. Who were the models, the literary models of this novel?
This category of fiction is called the place as a main character, in which the assumption of this category is that any place we are using in our daily life has a human history.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't see this history.
Mm-hmm.
So for the novelist to discover or to imagine the human history of the place.
Mm-hmm.
And all the characters will be related to the place, but the place is the main character. Like, for example, the great Yugoslavian novelist, mm-hmm. Ivo Andrić, who wrote a bridge on the Drina River. That yeah. was Lawrence Daril, Alexandria. Yeah.
Yes.
You know, Naguib Mahfouz yeah. used this category.
As well,
you know. I was really inspired by this category, mm-hmm. yeah. you see.
And you met the great novelist Naguib Mahfouz yourself when you were a young man in Cairo.
Yes, I was lucky because my father was a writer too, and a lawyer,
yes.
Abbas al-Aswani. And thanks to him, you know, I became a writer because my father told me from the very beginning, when I was 18 or 17, that potentially I could be a good writer, but I should do that and that. My father was a friend of Naguib Mahfouz, and I was lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met Mr. Naguib Mahfouz after even the death of my father. My father passed away, and then I met him. And he was such a great man. I met him before Nobel and after Nobel Award. He never changed,
mm-hmm.
and he was very inspiring to me.
Mm-hmm.
And once I met him by coincidence in Alexandria, that was 1980.
Mm-hmm.
I was very young. I was mm-hmm. just, I graduated from the dental school. And I found him in the next table in a cafeteria in Alexandria. And then I stood up and I presented myself, and he was happy. He said, you're the son of my friend, my dear friend. And then he invited me for coffee, and we spent 2 hours. And I was asking about everything. I tell you that these 2 hours were a turning point in my life, because he advised me, when he knew that I would like to mm-hmm. be a writer, he advised me very, very important advices.
Which were these advices?
He said that you should be, the reward should be writing itself.
Mm-hmm.
If you write for fame or you write for money, you will never be able to make it. This could come or could not come,
mm-hmm.
but you ask yourself honestly, is writing your reward? When you write something you like, are you happy enough to give up any other rewards? If the answer is yes, then go ahead. If the answer is no, I'm looking for fame, I'm looking for money, he said, it's not a good idea to write for fame or money, because you could reach those goals through other professions much easier.
Yes, very well. And Naguib Mahfouz's own work was influenced by the realist tradition of the 19th century, which he interpreted in his own way. I was struck by a comment you made recently about the difficulty of being able to say why a work, a novel, a literary work is good. It is very difficult to have objective criteria for expressing this judgment. In the case of Naguib Mahfouz, what strikes is that the literary techniques he uses are rather traditional. What is, in your opinion, the very peculiar and differentiating quality of Mahfouz's literature?
Well, I think that I usually say that the most important, as you said, element in a literary work, in good literature, the most important element is undefinable. You know, cannot define. I say this to my students of creative writing. Why? Because sometimes, or I would say even many times, people think that if you have one or two or three courses of creative writing, you'll be a good writer, which is, of course, is not true. I mean, you should be talented. And this talent is undefinable. But I give you my experience as a writer, so that if you are talented, you don't have to waste time, and you will know the common mistakes and you will avoid those mistakes. But this is one thing. The other thing in your question is that there were two schools. One school was founded by the French narration in the 50s, which is Le Nouveau Roman. And this Nouveau Roman wanted to get rid of the so-called traditional fiction, and they just gave up the characters, they gave up the story, and they didn't even appreciate the fact that a novel could be attractive, you know. This could have been helpful at some point, or probably it opened some opportunity for literature. But I would say, this is my opinion, that we with this kind of writing, we lost many readers, as a matter of fact. 1967, somebody came from the other school, and it was not Mahfouz, it was Garcia Marquez. Mm-hmm. And Garcia Marquez, in my opinion, saved the word novel, saved the novel. Why? Because he said, a novel to me is a cuento, is a story, and if you don't have characters, I don't understand how you're going to write novel if there are no characters. And he wrote what he wanted. And he wrote beautiful novels, masterpieces. Mahfouz belongs to this school. I belong to this school too. You know, I don't believe in a novel without characters and without story. And I don't believe in the term ordinary reader, because this term is supremacist. You know, if you say ordinary reader, it means that there is an extraordinary reader, right? I believe, and Marquez said the same thing, Mahfouz, Hemingway, many people, many Greek writers, They said that I learn from the feedback of the readers sometimes more than the reviews of the critics, sometimes, you know. Why? Because sometimes the readers don't have theories in their hand, in their head. So they tell you from their hearts how they feel. So I belong to this school, and I believe that a novel should be a pleasure to read. And if it's not a pleasure to read, the novel is missing something basic, because we should please our readers. We should not torture our readers, you see. And if the novel is boring, it's a big failure.
Well, you give us a lot of pleasure with your book.
Thank you very much.
With the Jacobean Building, and of course also with your last book. We will talk now about both. The first question to the Jacobean Building: how come you had that idea to write that novel?
Well, I was, of course, as I told you, I was. I read literature in French, English, Arabic, and Spanish with difficulties, but I read with dictionary. The dictionary was with the Spanish. So I knew that this category of the police as a main character. But I was walking one day in Garden City. Garden City was my neighborhood.
Yes.
And it's a kind of bourgeois neighborhood, but no more. It used to be a very elegant neighborhood. So the American embassy was demolishing a building. They cut the building as if the building was a piece of cheese.
Wow.
You see, they had the tools, yeah. The technology to do that. So I found myself before in a very interesting scene, that an old building was cut off. There were the rooms of mm-hmm. where the people lived for years. And some people, when they left, they didn't take everything. They left like all the newspapers.
Yeah.
And I stayed before this scene like more than 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Those rooms have a human history. In this room, for example, there was the first night of wedding, or the last moment of divorce, or somebody committed suicide. And I found myself, my head full of imagination. And then I decided to write the history of a building.
And the characters that appear in your novel, are they based on fiction?
Of course, the formula is fiction equal reality plus imagination.
Okay.
It's always, there is originally something true in your fiction, but you add to your imagination. From your imagination, you add to the reality, mm-hmm. or you change the reality.
Yes.
It's very rare, but it happens. And any novelist know that you find somebody, a real person, who could be a literary character without any change.
Yeah.
This is very rare, but it happens, and it happened to me.
Yeah. So it happened to you also. You told me that someone wanted to sue you because he thought that you were describing him as a real person in your novel.
Yeah, it didn't happen that he wanted to sue me. People sued me, really.
Really?
Yeah, okay. It was terrible. What happened is that the novel had become very successful in Cairo, and then in the Arab world, and then the whole world. And then the building has become very famous. And people, were very happy, the tenants and the responsible of the building and everything. They took photos with me and everything. And then came the movie. They thought that I took millions because of them, which is not true. Did search in the files of the tenants, and when he found something similar,
yes,
he sued me.
Yeah.
So I had to go before the judge, and we explained to the judge that you cannot, nobody can sue imagination.
Ah, that's right.
And this happened in France with Gustave Flaubert because of Madame Bovary in the 19th century. So I translated the defense of Flaubert, which is a piece of art.
Wonderful.
How he convinced the judge that you cannot sue in imagination. That was an autobiography or a newspaper diaries or something. You could sue me because I'm talking about what happened really, but this is an imagination. The judge was convinced. I saw that on his face. But of course, I was against the regime as usual. So the judge, this convinced judge, was changed in the last week. And then came another judge, and he didn't listen to us or anything. And I was sentenced 20,000 Egyptian pounds as a fine. And the publisher was sentenced 20,000 Egyptian pounds.
That's very difficult to believe this, but since you tell us this, it's also precious to know that these things happen.
Yeah, of course.
Which we forget when we buy a book.
Absolutely.
And we just have the pleasure of reading it. So your book was a bestseller in many places, but as you were saying, in the Arab country, there was an enormous response to it, also due to the film, I'm sure. How do you explain the success? Of course, it is the quality of the literature, but how come that this was for maybe a whole generation of Egyptian one book that was so important? How do you explain that?
I don't think, I never thought I am the right person to explain my success. But I could tell you that, I would talk generally, and the success, I was lucky, you know, that the success continued with the other novels, because it's not only this novel, but the other novels have been very successful. But I would say that you're talking about the Arab world. And in the Arab world, 60% of the Arab people are, 60% are young people under the age of 40 or 35.
Yes.
So you have new generation, and these young people, they want their rights, and they have different conscience. They are very much related through social media to the West. Mm-hmm. They want to be protected. They want protected by the law. They don't accept corruption anymore. They want, and what happened is that there were revolutions and there were counter-revolutions. The fact that this generation, it's interestingly, these young people read literature. Mm-hmm. Their parents don't, most of them.
Yeah. So it was read especially by younger people?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's very interesting.
I have had many awards in my life, many prestigious award of literature. But I remember, the biggest honor when in the revolution in Tahrir Square, this happened like 3 or 4 or 5 times or even more. A young man, revolutionary, in the Tahrir Square will come to salute me, and he would say, "We are here because of what you wrote." I believe that this is the highest honor and the highest award I have ever had.
So let's talk about this novel, which you will publish in many countries, and that describes the failed revolution of Tahrir Square. The first question is, we were talking before that you are not very fond of novels based on topics. From the outside, one would think a very important Arab writer writes now a novel on the topic of the revolution of Tahrir Square, which seems to be in contradiction to what you were saying.
No, so, it is not contradiction, because I don't say that the novel doesn't have a topic. I said that the art is more important than the topic. And the fact that you don't need to read 600 pages to know that the dictatorship, or we are ruled by a cruel dictator in Egypt, but you could know that through a report in any newspaper. But my job as a writer is to present the human beings who live under the dictatorship.
Yeah.
And this human content is the art. And this human content, if I know how to do it, will make my novel readable forever. You see, we read now Dostoevsky, and we read Tolstoy, Turgenev, Anton Chekhov. We read them, and they were talking about the 19th century Russian society, which doesn't exist anymore. But why we're still reading and learning from them? Because of the human content. Because I'm Egyptian, and I was born like 100 years after the death of Dostoevsky. But when I read Dostoevsky, I find people who are very similar to my colleagues or my cousin or my neighbors, because the human content is the most important thing.
Yes, and in this novel, you present us with many characters who, as you were saying, that you are fond of the novel based on characters, who represent different shades and ideologies of the Egyptian society. But these characters are also very complex. They can have conflicts, and they can have also a development. Let's start with talking about the general, Ahmad Alawani. Is that correct, how
yes.
I pronounce it?
Ahmad Alawani.
Exactly. His daughter, Dania, takes part in the revolutionary movement. So she is in a conflict between the loyalty to her own family and the need for a new society and the need to for freedom.
I believe that the social class decides your conscience. If you are paid 1,000 euro, you will think in a way, and if you're going to be paid 100,000 euro, you will think differently. Why? Because the social class, even if unconsciously, you don't have to understand this, but you will be this way, is that I am rich, I am giving, I live a wonderful life, I want to keep that, I'm against any revolution or against anything. If I'm starving, of course I will be for the revolution, because I have nothing to lose. So the social class decides your conscience and decides your political position. In history, there are very few people whose conscience overcame their social interests. Yes. You know, they have the conscience and the vision to defend the human values, even
despite their
social class and social interests.
So Dania would be one of these persons.
I know them.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that women would be stronger in that in today's Egypt?
Yeah, of course. The revolution was very much. The point when we say revolution, the revolution is not just a political change. The political change is the less important change in the revolution. The revolution, we say, we would like to stop the system and to demolish the system. The system is not only political. The system, the social system, the cultural system,
the ideology.
Your vision for the world,
yes.
Your vision for the woman. So I tell you that without the rule of the Egyptian woman, the revolution would have never been possible. And we had always at least one third of the revolutionary people were ladies, you know. And they spent they were in the front all the time, and it was very much provocative to the authorities, you know, because the authorities or the rulers of Egypt are not only far behind politically, but they are far behind culturally too. So they feel uncomfortable with a woman in the front of a manifestation, in the first line. They feel uncomfortable.
So the daughter of the general who is supporting the revolution, while her father is a representative of the status quo, who doesn't want things to change, represents also the hope that this movement can not just be defined a failed movement, but a movement that has already changed the country.
It has failed politically so far.
So far.
Yeah, okay. And I'm quite sure you read the history of revolutions, and the revolution needs time. Yeah. And as you said, the revolution is not only the political aspect, because the political could be changed, the political regime could be changed through a coup d'etat, you know, through a reform. But the revolution is much deeper, much more profound. And this is not visible for the authorities, for the regime. So they try, and this is what's happening in Egypt now, right? Is that they try to apply the old formula of oppression, and they believe that it will work. It will never work, you know. But if the revolution happens, everything will change. So the people who used to accept things, they will no more accept the same things. It's so, no more accepted.
So we are in a process. Dania falls in love with Khaled, who is then killed by police forces. I would like to focus on two important characters in your novel. In Germany, we have this term which is called Mitläufer. Mitläufer is the common man who just does what anyone else does. He thinks that he is not responsible for things, ugly things that happen. In your novel, we have two portraits of the common man. One is Khaled's father, and the other one is Ashraf. So these two people live in a society where they are kind of comfortable, but they have different reactions to the things that are happening in the country.
Yes, of course, but after years of dictatorship, you have, you call it the common man, but I called it in my book the good citizen.
The good citizen
wants stability much more than the freedom or justice. Why? Because he gave up dreaming. He doesn't dream. He has his individual project, and he belongs only to his family, to his kids. And his house And that's it. He doesn't believe, because there is no democracy. So he is following the dictator. He is following the mainstream, and he doesn't want any problem. And this is a very harmful kind of people. But they did exist after all years of dictatorship everywhere. How the people accept this is in my book. Not a dictator. How one single person could impose on his will on 30 or 40 or even 100 million people? Why? Because this is my assumption. Because I made a study, a comparative study about the dictators in the 20th century. And I found that it's not only one person, the dictator, appears when the people at this point could need a dictator, or they are prepared to accept a dictator. This is how a dictator is received.
By the
people.
By the good citizens.
Yes,
by the good citizens. And the way you describe the religious aspect in the novel, which is very much instrumentalized by politics. There is a critique in the book of religion being instrumentalized. Is there also a thought of religion as being part of the freedom process?
Yeah, that was always the case. If you accept the communist dictators, all the dictators of the 20th century, most of them had been using the religion, you know. And in Egypt, we have this problem, and it's a big problem. Why? Because since 1952, the coup d'etat of 1952, we have been cornered between two fascist forces, the military force and the Muslim Brother Force, and they are both fascists, and they have many things in common. They work with each other. They made a deal. I believe that the political Islam, and here I should be clear that the Islam as a religion, it's like Judaism or Christianity. Somebody's Muslim or Buddhism, whatever. I mean, this is something totally personal. And of course, I have respect for all the beliefs of anybody. But the political Islam is different than the Islam. The political Islam, the belief in the Islamic State is that Muslims should fight and should dominate the world. This is very dangerous. And the political Islam has been one major reasons, among the major reasons, why we haven't had democracy in the Arab world, because of the politicals.
I know that you have just finished a book on the dictatorship and that you're writing a novel about Cairo in a different time.
Alexandria.
Oh, about Alexandria.
Yeah. As you know, my friend, I cannot finish a novel and begin another one. It's never happened to me. I should have a pause, usually 1 year. And I write some non-fiction or something. So I wrote this book during this year. Now I'm back to fiction. I don't decide for novels, you know, I discover them.
Yeah, or they find you.
Exactly. I have novels in me, in my heart, in my mind. I discover them. So I'm very much related to Alexandria. And I have been always inspired by the cosmopolitan Alexandria. I lived when I was a kid in the 60s. That was the end. It was a turning point. The city, which had been cosmopolitan for centuries, was closing. And I have captured this moment. And you find how the city is changing. How it was and how it became, you see?
For us, I have to say that I'm very much fascinated by Alexandria because of that literary tradition they had with Cavafis, with Ungaretti being born there, with the Alexander Quartet by Darrell. So this is a quite extraordinary epoch, because this city, which was just, I think, a village on Fusi, it turned into a big capital, very much influenced by Europeans, Jews, very many, and its wealth lasted maybe just 100 years, and then all people left.
Everybody it's a
very short story of a very cosmopolitan city, which reminds me personally of Prague, of Kafka's Prague, of Trieste, these cities which had a mix, which made them so interesting and so ethereal, so not real, and then they disappeared like a dream.
Yeah. I mean, that was a turning point, because what happened is that, you know, Nasser came to power, and he, like any dictator, he should present some idea that could attract the people emotionally. And he made the life of the, they were Egyptians of European origins. He made their life impossible, easily. So they had to leave. Alexandria was like Andalusia, the formula of tolerance.
Yes.
This doesn't happen every day in history. Everybody was accepted.
So we are very much looking forward to this novel, which will be, I suppose, a nostalgic novel, because it goes back into the past. Seems to be a wonderful work, and so we are very
Thank you very much.
And wish you for your work the necessary inspiration and also calm, and we hope of course that your personal situation can improve, that the situation of your country can improve, that you can have the relationship to the readers in Egypt and all over the world. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, my dear friend, for this wonderful interview. Thank you.
Das war es für heute mit dem Podcast Hansa Rauschen. Das waren viele Worte für viele interessante Dinge. Bis zur nächsten Folge und danke fürs Zuhören.